I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, how cities are paying big time for the subprime mortgage crisis, but also turning around abandoned properties with innovations like you mow the lawn, you get to own the house. But first, more help is on the way for struggling homeowners outside of the subprime crisis. Today, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson announced Project Lifeline, a joint project with six of the largest mortgage lenders. Project Lifeline gives homeowners unable to meet any kind of mortgage a 30-day suspension on foreclosures so they can try to negotiate more affordable loan terms. Some critics are already calling it a PR stunt. We want to find out more from Damian Paletta. He's been covering the story for The Wall Street Journal. Damian, exactly who qualifies for this Project Lifeline program?
Well, it would be homeowners that are more than 90 days behind on their mortgage. Those are people considered seriously delinquent. And there's a couple of qualifiers. For example, they're not allowed to be in the bankruptcy process. They also, it can't be a loan for a vacant or investment property.
And what are the other qualifications? Is it just anyone who's behind?
Well, 90 days or more, right. It doesn't just apply for people with subprime loans like previous plans. Mm-hmm. This will be someone with a prime loan or any type of mortgage that essentially is on the brink of foreclosure.
How many Americans are we talking about here?
I think we're talking about, there's probably about close to 1.5 million people that are 90 days or more past due or already in the foreclosure process. It's not clear. I mean, not all of those would qualify for this program, but right. I think we're talking about, you know, a large group of people.
And why? Because we know the subprime loans suddenly jumped into stratospheric interest rates, and that
right.
created that crisis. Why is this group having such trouble?
Well, I think it wasn't only the subprime. I think it was a lot of the adjustable rate mortgages that started with lower rates and adjusted higher. And a lot of those loans were originated several years ago, and so they're rising higher now. So it's very easy for someone who maybe had, you know, a $1,200 mortgage now has a $2,200 mortgage, even if they're a prime customer, to be quickly 90 days behind on their loan.
And we should say the customers have to be customers of the lenders who are involved. These six lenders represent, we understand, about a half of outstanding mortgages. Who are the lenders?
Bank of America, Citigroup, Countrywide, J.P. Morgan, Washington Mutual, and Wells Fargo, and the Treasury Secretary urged other lenders to also offer this option for their customers.
Well, now, these same lenders also teamed up with the Bush administration at the end of last year to freeze interest rates on some of the subprime mortgages we were talking about.
That's right.
So what's been the verdict on that program, given that we now have this new program?
Well, that program, just remember, just applies to subprime loans, and for those, mostly, it's people that aren't behind. So this new program is for any loan, and really it's for people that are on the brink of foreclosure. We're still waiting to get data on the success of the program, although the Bush administration is saying today that more than 800,000 borrowers have been helped. But we're not sure how many of those have actually had their loans modified, or maybe if they were just able to get, you know, an extra month to work
right.
out their loans.
What kind of help?
Right.
Well,
so we're going to know more maybe at the end of this month about the specifics.
Well, you spoke with Bruce Marks of the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, and he's one of the critics. He's quite a gadfly in the housing industry, and he called today's move a PR stunt.
Right.
Why?
Well, consumer groups and a lot of Democrats, they want the administration and these lenders to do more than just send letters to these homeowners. I mean, this process wouldn't just buy people 30 extra days to avoid foreclosure. There'd be a letter sent to them. They'd have to call their bank, and then they'd have to sort of discuss whether or not they're going to be able to save the loan. And if they might be able to save the loan, then they could have more time. But, you know, a lot of times people don't open the letters they get from their lenders if they're already sort of in trouble. So I think the consumer groups and the Democrats want more proactive steps taken.
Such as?
For example, there's a bill sponsored by Democrats in the House right now that would allow bankruptcy judges to alter the terms of a mortgage of someone in foreclosure to maybe lower the interest rate or, you know, to change the principal that's due. And that's sort of fiercely debated in Congress right now. The banking industry is really opposed to it.
Yeah.
But it might get more interest if things worsen.
Damian Paletta reports for The Wall Street Journal. Damian, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, as it trickles down, the foreclosure crisis is taking a major chunk out of the budgets of cities across the country. The U.S. Conference of Mayors projects that foreclosures could cost city governments $166 billion this year. That's billion dollars. For example, the average vacant building in Chicago costs that city $34,000. Here in Boston, it can cost $1,700 just to board up an abandoned property. Well, many towns are now turning to Flint, Michigan for advice. That city's economy went into a tailspin in the 1980s when several local car factories closed down, 79,000 General Motors jobs at the peak. there to less than 15,000 today. About 6 years ago, the county created a land bank to turn vacant buildings and lots into homes and community gardens. Dan Kildee is the county treasurer and president of the Genesee County Land Bank, and we are going to have an extended conversation with him today. Dan, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be on the show.
Well, first of all, we have so much to ask you about. But first of all, your thoughts on today's proposal, help for people even outside of the subprime loans, people with prime loans struggling and perhaps getting maybe as much as a month of a freeze.
Well, I think everything will help. I am concerned that these are people, and these are folks that I deal with on a regular basis, that they really are struggling with all aspects of their sort of economic situation. And what we have found is that much more active case management, literally sitting down with people across their kitchen table and walking them through their entire family budget, is what's required. You know, sending a letter and offering them a chance to refinance might help many of the people, but I'm convinced that a lot of the folks that are struggling are going to need more help than what that might provide.
And Dan, just quickly, because we want to talk about what you are doing, because other cities are looking to you once somebody has foreclosed. But, you know, for those who are thinking, what is this, just lazy, economics? Are these people who just can't keep their checkbook? What are the factors? Why are so many people struggling with paying their mortgage?
Well, I think if you look at the type of loans that banks have offered over the last half decade or so, there were mistakes made on both sides of the table. When people borrow money with either interest-only loans or adjustable-rate mortgages, they don't think about the consequences of rate increases. By the same token, the banks that are making these loans understand that some of the folks that they're loaning money to, if the rates go up, simply are not going to be able to pay these mortgages. So it's really, I think, a matter of people thinking that the good times last forever and making decisions on that basis and not really thinking, well, what happens if things change? And now we're seeing the result of that.
Right, we are. With all these abandoned houses across the country, we've been stunned at some of the side effects of the foreclosures. For instance, early on in this recent crisis, we spoke with a cop in Arizona who found himself in charge of putting fish in abandoned backyard pools because the fish were needed to eat the mosquitoes that were, you know, birthed by the algae that was growing in the pools. Now, who would have thought? And suddenly those towns are, you know, stressed by that, responsibility. What are some of the financial drains that you're dealing with?
Well, the biggest problem with any community that has significant abandonment is the effect that abandoned properties have on the quality of life and then ultimately on the surrounding property values. So with significant abandonment, which this mortgage crisis will exacerbate, communities struggle to deal directly with the problems of abandoned property, more fires, more crime, more disease, all the problems that are associated with the properties themselves. And then those very properties decrease the value of the surrounding land, which diminishes the tax revenue that community then has available to deal with an increased service demand. So getting our arms around this problem of vacant and abandoned property, it's something that a lot of us are working on. We have a national campaign, the National Vacant Properties Campaign, which was formed about 5 years ago, to try to help communities deal with these problems and to minimize the negative effects of vacant and abandoned property.
You also have something called a land bank. You've bought up in the Flint area, in the county there, abandoned properties, and you are giving them out to people who wouldn't ever be able to afford them, either to rent, to rent, to buy. In fact, let's listen first of these 6,300 properties that you've acquired by the land bank starting in 2002. You've sold about 2,300 to private individuals. And then, as we said, you have these rent-to-own programs. We called up 55-year-old Marilyn Tyler of Flint. She is now living in a land bank property she hopes to buy someday. We asked her to start by describing it.
Oh, my. It's a big three-bedroom home. No basement, but that's a blessing. That's a plus for me. And I have a huge living room, walks out onto a patio deck in the back, fenced-in backyard. I love it. It's gorgeous.
What is your rent a month?
Okay, $425.
Wow. Would you be able to find that size of a house at that rent?
No. In the city of Flint, Michigan, and for the area that I'm in, for a three-bedroom for $425, that's like being dropped heaven out of the sky.
Well, now, do you plan to buy it?
Yes, I do. I've already done what I've had to do, okay?
Yeah.
I've had to live here a year and keep my rent payment up on time. So I've already passed that.
What will you need to buy the house? Will you need to then put down?
I don't even need a down payment. When I talked to Dave at the land bank, Dave says, I don't need any money down. And I said, Dave, look, I'm 55 years old. I don't want a 30-year mortgage. I want to live long enough to pay for the house. My payment will go down once I begin to buy somewhere in the area of $100.
So your rent, if you buy, your rent will just be converted to payments towards the house, but the rent will drop $100 if you buy.
Yes. And then... I got a steal. I got a steal.
I'm wondering, too, Marilyn, if you must see boarded-up houses in the area. Everybody
all
does.
All over. I was born and raised right here in the city of Flint.
When you saw those houses now you're living in one that was, foreclosed, did you find yourself thinking, geez, why can't we just have people living in those?
Yes, all the time.
We understand you're on Social Security disability now, having raised your kids. Are you convinced that you can continue the payments on this house?
I've been doing it for a year and a half. It's not going up.
That's right. It's going down.
Uh-huh.
Marilyn Tyler in Flint, Michigan, renting a land bank property, which she's soon going to be buying. Marilyn, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Well, Dan Kildee of the Genesee County Land Bank there in Michigan, you've got one happy customer there in that house.
Nice to hear.
Yeah, she's very happy. And she's asked for something called a land contract. Does this mean that to buy the house, she wants to have her contract or mortgage directly with you and not with a bank?
That's right. We can, because we get these properties after they've been abandoned, our priority is to get them into productive use and to create homeowners. And because we own the property outright, we can enter into terms with somebody like Marilyn, and it places the highest value on creating a new homeowner in a place like Flint and getting her some equity that then she can use for her retirement and, for whatever she wants to do with it. In a community like Flint, the value of a homeowner like Marilyn is much more important than cashing in, as many communities do across the country, by simply selling these types of properties at a public auction or through the internet for a few dollars. It really makes no sense in the long term to not take the opportunity to create private wealth and put it in the hands of somebody like Marilyn on terms that make sense to us.
That's Dan Kildee. He's county treasurer, but also president of Michigan's Genesee County Land Bank. They buy up abandoned homes and then have rent-to-own programs, also mow-to-own. We want to hear about that as well. The idea being charged $425 a month rent. It may not be what you'd get to sell it, but it puts someone in the house and in that way saves the county money. And other cities are looking to Michigan for direction. We're going to hear more from Dan about their innovative programs and also what's going on across the country. Later in the program, former Democratic presidential candidate Gary Hart as well. He lost, he says, the presidential nomination in 1984 to the superdelegates. We'll talk superdelegates as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're talking about the impact of foreclosures across the country. In Buffalo, that city's going to spend $100 million to demolish 5,000 abandoned homes. RealtyTrack has targeted these cities as trouble spots. Stockton, California, one in 31 homes is in foreclosure. Detroit, one in 33 homes. Riverside, California, one in 43 homes is in foreclosure. We've been speaking with Dan Kildee. He's president of the Genesee County Land Bank in Flint, Michigan. And the foreclosures were causing that area so much money that they've come up with something called the land bank. And Dan, you say the vacant properties were bringing down the value of nearby homes. Michigan State University did a study looking at your program. What do they find about what happens when a city takes care of those abandoned homes?
Well, it was really interesting. We all know that abandonment decreases the value of surrounding properties. So Michigan State's Land Policy Institute measured the positive impact of our intervention. They looked at 400 properties where we spent $3.5 million and then looked at the increased property values and found that just in the surrounding properties, aggregate values went up $112 million. So we spent $3.5 million to gain $112 million of private wealth that is now restored to these surrounding property owners.
And in addition, as you said, you have the invaluable notion that you're putting people into abandoned homes that otherwise may not have housing. We just heard from Marilyn, one new renter in a formerly abandoned home. How do you choose these people, though? I mean, how do you make sure that this isn't, you know, taken advantage of?
Well, they choose us, really. I mean, the land bank, we do have an awful lot of property. We've taken title to 6,300 properties. We've been able to reconvey about 2,300 of those.
I guess the question is, how do you avoid having the same problem all over again with those homes being snatched up by speculators who then just turn them around and rent them to people who maybe can't afford the mortgage, and you start the cycle over again?
That's really what the land bank was intended to prevent. Mm-hmm. Most communities simply sell to whomever will buy the property. We place a higher priority on creating home ownership than we do on making money. So if we have two competing interests for a particular property, if a potential homeowner doesn't really have the kind of money that the speculator might have, we will still have a bias in favor of that homeowner, not just because that's what our values state, but in the long term, it's just wise economics.
Well, and in addition to the rent to own, you have mow to own programs. What does that mean?
Well, we have a lot of vacant and abandoned lots scattered throughout the city. Many of them are right next door to a homeowner who has sat there and watched this thing deteriorate for so long. Our pledge is if you'll take care of the property, you can get a chance to get a hold of that property, to own it yourself, really for nothing.
Either
for a dollar or just a few dollars, or just to take care of it, and then we will grant it to you.
I was going to say, you have a, you know, pay a dollar. I think it's shooting up to $25 in April for an abandoned house that might be right next to you.
So
we understand the way you can afford this, because that's got to be the question, is that you also, if you have, you know, prime properties, you might sell those to a retailer, let's say, for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that helps you pay for the program. It subsidizes it.
That is right. I mean, it's a countywide land bank. We get land throughout the entire county. We are able to liquidate those properties that are not in these at-risk neighborhoods by selling them to either new homeowners or developing them as commercial properties. And it's sort of a Robin Hood. We take these high-value properties, liquidate their value, and then we can spend money in neighborhoods in Flint, Michigan, that otherwise could never really justify the kind of public investment that our land bank is able to provide.
Well, Dan Kildee, again, up there with the Michigan Genesee County Land Bank, I guess over there from where we are in Boston. We know other cities are looking to you for help, and other cities are having problems. An official in Cleveland noted that vacant properties are often stripped of their resources, like aluminum, and this official said that's like stripping jewelry off a corpse. I mean, you know, these buildings are often in terrible shape. What are some of the questions that cities have for you?
Well, I think the biggest issue is, how do you pay for all this? How do you actually come up with an economic model that gets you the resources to fix these properties? And the way we do it, we rewrote our foreclosure laws here in Michigan. If you ever stayed up too late and saw these goofy infomercials where people learn how to buy tax foreclosed properties, basically, we changed that system, and now our land bank is the smartest and luckiest investor. So we actually get the revenue that otherwise would enrich out-of-state speculative investors. And that's really the fundamental change that most communities, I think anyway, need to make. And so when we're working with other communities, it's not that they don't know what to do or what they would like to do. It's that they can't develop the resources to do it. It's our land bank approach is fundamentally an economic model as much as it is a land use model, and that's what we're trying to encourage other communities to look at.
In Cleveland, there are 17,000 vacant foreclosed properties, and many times companies, mortgage companies that own the properties, just don't show up in court to answer, you know, housing code violations. So a judge there in Cleveland put 12 companies on trial in absentia. They can't sell the properties until they pay up. In North Carolina, where the foreclosure rate is expected to jump 20% this year to 60,000 foreclosures, the state has pledged $300,000 to pay for financial counselors, you know, so that, as we were hearing at the beginning of the program, people can understand if there is help out there for them. Is this kind of preventive talk also being heard in Michigan? I mean, you guys have been at this a lot longer than some other cities because of the auto industry crisis, but is the idea, too, to keep people in their homes to prevent the foreclosures?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a foreclosure prevention program ourselves. We pulled 1,700 families out of foreclosure because it makes sense for us to move upstream rather than just dealing with abandonment to try to prevent abandonment in the first place. The most important message, though, I think, is for those communities out there across the state or across the country that think they're bulletproof, that think they have this unbelievably strong real estate market that can't be touched, they better think twice, because there are cities across this country right now that are very strong market cities that are calling us, never thinking they would need our help, but they're calling us to ask, how do you deal with this problem? How do you prevent foreclosure? How do you deal with the downstream effects of abandoned properties? Mm-hmm. They're not used to this question, and I think they're waking up.
Yeah. Another thing that you are doing, converting empty lots into open space, urban gardens, so much going on there in Michigan. Dan Kildee, County Treasurer, also President of the Michigan Genesee County Land Bank. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much.
And, of course, we'll continue to cover this story, the side effect of foreclosure. Later today, though, the question that might be asked of Roger Clemens when he goes to Washington tomorrow, he definitely won't have to face his good friend and former teammate Andy Pettit. More on that after the news here and now. As voters go to the polls today in Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia, some might be wondering if their votes will ultimately matter. A debate is growing in the Democratic Party over whether the superdelegates will be the ones to decide the nominee. The superdelegates are those 800 Democratic Party bigwigs, governors, members of Congress, who get seats at the convention and can vote for anyone they want. It was an idea created after party officials moved the nominating process away from the politicians and out of the smoky back rooms to give the popular vote more sway. Then, after bitter primary battles between Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy in 1980, officials decided to give a little more of that power back to party insiders, and that directly affected our next guest. Gary Hart won the popular vote in the primaries in 1984, but his opponent, Walter Mondale, then convinced more superdelegates to support him, and he became the party's nominee. Gary Hart joins us from Denver now. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Does it still smart a little?
Oh, no. Hardly. It's only been 24 years.
Yeah. Well, given your experience, today the talk is that this may happen again at the convention, that superdelegates may once again be the deciders. Where do you fall on the current debate on what those delegates should be doing? Should they be committing now? Are they being fiercely lobbied? Should they wait until the convention to make up their mind? And if the vote is determined at the convention, should they just go with the popular vote?
There is no perfect solution. As you indicated, the reason they exist at all is to reward loyalty and service to the party and to give elected officials and party officials a voice in the convention deliberations, not just the candidate, but the platform and so on. They all have a stake in the direction the party is going. I think, on balance, they should wait at least until each of their states has had its primary and caucus, and then largely be conditioned by that. Now, I know in Massachusetts, a number of the senior officials there, including both senators and the governor, endorsed Senator Obama before the Massachusetts primary, and they obviously need to honor that endorsement.
That's one of the controversies. You're right, here in Massachusetts, although some of the top officials like Kennedy and Kerry did endorse Obama, the state went with Hillary Clinton. Now, we should say that you are not a superdelegate, but you have said you do support Barack Obama.
Yes.
He called, your candidate said a week or so ago, that he feels the superdelegates should go with their states. Well, Hillary Clinton came back and said, that's just fine, because in Massachusetts, that means I get yours, meaning Kennedy and Kerry. So I don't know if that's reflected, you know, as much across the country, but you do think that they should generally stay with the state vote?
Given the range of choices that you outlined, it seems to me the fairest. But even that is problematic because it takes away the independence of the elected officials. In the case of Senators Kerry and Kennedy, they have served with both of the candidates, and they make a judgment that is somewhat more sophisticated than that of the voters. They've seen both candidates up close. So the short answer to your question is, I don't know. I think it's a tough call either way.
Well, because I was going to say, Clinton supporters could say, oh, well, you're just saying that because that means if they were, you know, to stay with the one they committed to as opposed to the popular vote here in Massachusetts, they would choose your guy.
Well, as you can see, I'm ambivalent about it. I don't have a black and white answer.
Well, what is happening, though? Because there are those who say, Tad Devine, who's now an analyst, who was Walter Mondale's delegate counter in 84, who says super delegates shouldn't do anything before the convention. What about the lobbying? Do you think that should be happening now?
Well, of course, but I must take issue with Mr. Devine. I sent a letter off to the New York Times, which unfortunately I don't think they will print, because he did not accurately represent what happened in 84. He suggested in his opinion piece in the New York Times Sunday that the superdelegates had waited until after the primaries to decide. That, in fact, did not happen. The late Tip O'Neill and a whole lot of other senior officials pre-endorsed Vice President Mondale even before the primaries began, and they felt obligated after the country divided itself between the two of us to honor that commitment, and Vice President Mondale got all the delegates. And so Mr. Devine's piece was not quite accurate as to what transpired in 84.
Well, point taken from someone who was there. But do you think his other point is valid, that, you know, now, today, there shouldn't be this lobbying? It's such a tight race. What should be happening now? Should people be lobbying the superdelegates? And what does happen, by the way?
There's nothing wrong with that. I think the candidates can call superdelegates and ask for their support. That's, in fact, a different way of campaigning, which they do every day. They're on their feet before hundreds, if not thousands, of people saying, I want your help, I want your support. So there's nothing wrong with the candidates or their surrogates calling these delegates. One would hope that they would not use undue pressure, which has been known to happen.
Well, in fact, you told Matt Bayh of the New York Times that you and your wife called every superdelegate personally in 84, and a woman from Kentucky told your wife that she wanted to vote for you, but her husband worked for the State Highway Department, and she said she'd been told her husband would lose his job if she did.
Well, I think that goes on. That isn't lobbying. That's beyond arm twisting. That's arm breaking. That obviously should not go on. But I think people in Massachusetts, among other places, would not be surprised that it does happen every day.
What about the people who are making the calls? Just to get your opinion on the most recent kerfuffle, the Clinton campaign is using Chelsea Clinton to call superdelegates. As you know, MSNBC host David Schuster got in trouble for using, you know, as everyone seems to agree, outrageous language to describe her use. But is that unusual for the family of a candidate to get on the phone and start calling?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
It was not unusual for my wife to call people.
And what else happens? Is it just the phone call, or are there gift baskets? I mean, what is going on right now?
Well, ask other people. I don't know.
Nobody's calling you?
I assume that people are calling. You know, it's phone calls. If they're sending Valentines or bouquets of flowers, fine.
Donna Brazile, who, as you know, ran Al Gore's campaign in 2000, has said she'll quit her post on the party if the superdelegates do end up deciding the nominee this year rather than the popular vote. Do you worry about what's happening with the party
well,
with this close?
That's exactly what's going to happen, but why she should be surprised by that possibility kind of amazes me. Of course, it's 20% of the votes. What else are they supposed to do?
Do you think that the party will perhaps change once again?
If a large number of delegates see the process here in Denver in August as being unfair, there will be some kind of rebellion, perhaps people just staying home in the fall. And once again, there will be another commission by the party to try to think through how you balance the interests of party regulars and party officials with the voters at large. There's no perfect answer.
That's former Senator and former presidential candidate Gary Hart speaking with us about the Democratic superdelegates, the role they're playing this year in the nominating process. Senator Hart, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
And by the way, on the Republican side, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee is also saying his party bigwigs have too much power after that squabble over caucus results in Washington State. The party chair there called the race for John McCain this weekend before all the votes were counted, saying it was going McCain's way. Huckabee contested that call. In the latest reporting, the party chair now says more votes have been counted. McCain is still the winner. Stay tuned. And stay tuned because tomorrow here on Here and Now, dancer Bill T. Jones on mixing politics and art, and also an historian who says the rumors of the death of marriage have been greatly exaggerated. That's all tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Roger Clemens returns to Capitol Hill tomorrow to answer questions about steroid use from the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, and also to try to save his reputation as one of baseball's best pitchers. One potentially dramatic confrontation has been removed. Clemens won't have to face his friend and former teammate Andy Pettitte, who was dismissed by the committee last night and who has admitted to taking steroids. Clemens will face his accuser, former trainer Brian McNamee, who alleged in the Mitchell report that he injected Clemens and Pettitte with performance-enhancing drugs during their days with the New York Yankees. Well, Brian Costello is a reporter for the New York Post. Brian, first of all, what happened? Why was Pettitte excused?
Well, it's a little mysterious, and they're not really telling us the full story, I don't think. But it seems like to me Pettitte had asked last week after he gave his deposition if he could be excused from the hearing. And the committee felt that he had cooperated fully with them and given them what they needed, and they agreed to it. And his deposition that he gave last week will still be used tomorrow to ask questions from and to bring up points from. So, you know, they still have testimony from him, but it seems that they felt he was a cooperative witness, and they also worried a little bit about Andy under the spotlight, how he would be as a witness, because he was a little shaky in that deposition.
And yet others were wondering what it would be like to have these two former best friends sitting next to each other at a hearing table. And, you know, is it possible that maybe some grown-up baseball players, now policymakers, didn't want to do that, didn't want to put these two best friends next to each other?
Yes, you know, I found a lot of these congressmen talk pretty tough, but then, you know, they're willing to give the concessions to some of these ballplayers, especially the focus of this is Clemens. It wasn't Pettitte. Man, I guess Andy's lawyers really argued that he had done everything he could do and there really wasn't much use for him Wednesday, and I think they appreciated that he was a stand-up guy, and they excused him.
Well, as we mentioned, Andy Pettitte has already confessed to using human growth hormones. You've compiled a list of things the House committee should ask Roger Clemens tomorrow, and one of those questions has to do with Pettitte. What's that question?
Yeah, I still think that's a good question. Pettitte backed up McNamee's story that he had used growth hormone, and Pettitte and McNamee had injected him. So if McNamee is telling the truth about Pettitte, why would McNamee lie about Roger Clemens and not about Andy Pettitte?
It was their thinking, too, that if Pettitte were sitting there right next to, again, his former teammate and friend, he might say something like, come on, Roger.
I mean, ballplayers stick by each other. It's a lot like the police force or a fraternity, actually. You know, they stick by each other. And that might have been the committee's concern, too, is that if he was there under the spotlights, he might not have said what you just said. He might have backed off of
what he's already intimidated by Roger.
Yeah, because if you remember Curt Schilling, 2005, they brought him into the hearing and they thought he was going to be their witness that would tell the truth about steroids, because Curt had said this a lot of stuff publicly, and he completely backed off.
Tick off a couple of the other questions that you want asked of Roger Clemens.
I think they need to explore what he knew about steroids in baseball. A lot of times people have said they didn't know anything about it, which is hard to believe. So I'd like to hear, you know, what he knew about it and kind of what his background was with discussions with people. I think there's a lot of discrepancies, too, between what McNamee has said and what he has said that he needs to be asked about.
Some of the other questions. You also wonder why a professional athlete who makes his living using his body would allow someone who's not the team doctor to inject him with anything. What has Clemens said to that question so far?
I actually asked him that question in Houston in January, and he said he thought McNamee was a doctor, which is kind of hard to believe because McNamee was a strength trainer. He's a guy like that when you go to your gym would design a workout for you. He's not a guy who's in the locker room administering medicine or taping ankles and that kind of thing. And Clemens has argued, well, a lot of people injected me with stuff, which is probably true. But the only reason you would have your strength coach inject you with anything is if it was illegal and you were trying to hide it from the team.
You sound now and in your columns as if you don't believe Roger Clemens' claim that he wasn't injected with human growth hormone, and going further, if he was, he didn't know it. Is there something he could say that would change your mind?
I don't know what that is right now, and I've tried to maintain an open mind, but there's a lot of holes in Roger's story, and it just doesn't seem to wash.
Brian Costello, reporter for the New York Post. Hearings begin tomorrow in Washington to try to get at the truth of steroid use in baseball and by pitcher Roger Clemens. Brian, thanks for speaking to us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And in just 1 minute, those stories of modern love, maybe they've grabbed you on Sunday in the New York Times. That's in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And just in time for Valentine's Day, a look at that barometer of relationships, the Modern Love column from the Sunday Style section of the New York Times. For over 3 years, in first-person essays, contributors have told their stories of love in all its forms. Some of the topics: a woman who marries a trophy husband, the daughter who finds out after her father dies that his fishing buddy knew much more about him than his family did. That was a personal favorite. Or the one about the widower finding love again after the death of his beloved wife.
Late one night, after agonizing about it for days, do I really? Yeah. Is it time? Maybe. Will I scare her off? Probably not, but maybe. Am I really sure? Yeah. I tell Suzanne that I love her. What did you say? You're mumbling. I repeat myself, trying my best to articulate and project. I love you. I feel relieved and happy, but also guilty. For 14 years, those words belonged only to Kirsten, but now they also belong to Suzanne. And so, for the first time in my life, I find myself in love with two women at the same time. If both were alive, this would constitute a pretty serious problem.
That's Brendan Halpin reading from his Modern Love account. His is one of many columns collected in the book Modern Love, 50 True and Extraordinary Tales of Desire, Deceit, and Devotion. We spoke to Brendan and Daniel Jones, who edited the book last year when it was first published. Daniel is also the editor of the Modern Love column, and he told us it's quite a workload.
We get hundreds of submissions every month. Yeah,
I bet they do.
The confessions pour in.
Just tick through, and I'll start with some of the topics that, you know, who expects to find a gay high schooler who gets asked to take everyone else to the prom, all the girls to the prom when they need a date. Someone goes through a relationship, the entire arc, almost entirely through text messaging.
There's one called The Third Half of a Couple, where a guy who can't find a date or is so uncomfortable around women, and he gloms onto a married couple and becomes the stability of their marriage, and tagging along with them to everything is where, you know, he finds his relationship.
Right. Some of the columns are flippant, and then some just break your heart. And that brings us to one of your contributors who's sitting here with me, Brendan Halpin from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. And Brendan, you read a little bit of your column in the introduction about your wife dying of cancer, was it?
Yeah, breast cancer.
And then just trying to figure out what you do from there. I remember reading that and I was like, oh, God. You know, tell us more about what was happening to you when you were in love with two women.
Well, it was just a very strange experience to mix that elation of infatuation with grief. But having spent several months in the sort of, you know, grief and despair stage, adding some elation and joy into the mix was a really happy addition.
And this was the woman that you began dating, that you write about, that you've ultimately married and
yes.
blended your families.
Yes.
You both had kids.
Yes.
You write in your essay for Modern Love about a dream that you had that became a metaphor, that you and your late wife, Kirsten, had gone to a mall.
Right. And she went up to the bookstore, which was on the third floor, and I was going with her. And then I realized, well, where's Rowan, our daughter Rowan? She was very unconcerned and was like, well, you have to go get her, which was, you know, just completely unlike her when she was alive. And I was, like, a little annoyed with her in the dream. I was like, well, geez, all right. So, you know, I go running down to the ground floor, and there's Rowan, and I just sort of threw my arms around her, and then I woke up. I felt like that was sort of either my subconscious or, you know, Kirsten or something telling me that I was where I belong. She was moving on. I mean, she had moved on.
It's a lovely thought, but as you write, you're really annoyed with your subconscious for choosing a mall. But at least Kirsten's in the bookstore.
Right. I mean, you know, if if that's an accurate vision of the afterlife, yeah. I'm sure she's content. But,
And Daniel, when this comes across your desk, it's so beautifully written. As it turns out, Brendan is a writer. But stories like this are often from people who just, you know, they've never written, and they're putting out this incredibly personal thing. What are you thinking when you're reading these?
Part of my vision for the column is to have a real broad base of experience and have people really from all over. And, you know, you mentioned earlier an 18-year-old high school student writing about what it's like to be invited to all these proms as a gay, you know, sort of escort. You don't find stories like that by conceiving them yourself and trying to find someone to write it. You need to rely on people, some often, you know, who aren't writers, to send them in.
What is it, Brendan, for you? Because there's a lot of personal stuff in here about, you know, kissing a new woman, feeling like you're betraying your late wife. And what was that like for you to write it? And then it's out there, style section, everyone sees it.
What was hard for me in writing this, and one of the reasons that I really wanted to write on this topic, was actually revisiting the time when Kirsten was dying. This was the first thing that I wrote about that. And that was the part that was really difficult for me to write. In terms of stuff being out there in front of people, I think there's some shame part that's missing in my brain because I just didn't care. Like, I don't know.
But yours was a column that just, you know, you read it aching and loving the ache. Others, Daniel, I've read and I've thought, what is this person thinking, telling me about this affair she had with the younger man? Or I think I already know the answer. Do you ever, like, you want to contact someone and say, really, I don't know if you, do you really want that in the New York Times?
I ask that every so often. I do feel about the column that honesty is disarming. And people who step out there and say, this is my life, these are my flaws, these are my conflicts, and this is what I've done, it can make a reader sit back in a maybe sort of morbid fascination, but also admiration.
Well, and in some, they don't name names. I'm thinking of the one when a girl has an affair with a married musician and she's so thinking he's so into her. And then as she travels on his website, she gets through to a link of another girl having an affair with a musician. And she's right out there. I mean, her name, the first girl who was having the affair, her name's right on the article.
That's one interesting thing about doing this in a newspaper. We have to follow the rules of the newspaper. You know, a lot of these pieces, when they appear in a magazine, it'll be with a pseudonym and with changed names and changed details. And we aren't allowed to do that. So you do have to own up to your experience and put your name on it.
Yeah. She calls herself a blog stalker. You know, as she went deeper in to try to find the other mistress of the musician she had been having the affair with. And that brings to mind something that you write in the introduction, that a lot of these essays involve modern technology. You know, we think modern technology has in many ways changed love, but has it really? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, there are two parts to that. I mean, love never changes. You know, for hundreds of years and thousands of years, we all have the same emotions and jealousies and conflicts. But the means change, and technology has, it's created this smorgasbord of love, you know, and opportunity where someone used to be limited by the people who live near them, and now there they are, this vast sea of faces of people who are looking for somebody else. God, I don't know. I'm not on the prowl right now myself, but if I were, I'd find that a little overwhelming.
Do you have people who write to you about these stories? I mean, what do readers say about them? And are there some that, you know, have really had more response than others?
Yes, and this was a surprise to me. I expected when we posted an email address that we would get, you know, nicely written letters to the editor that said, this is a very nicely written essay, or this is a very badly written essay, or this is a typo in the piece. Instead, the vast majority of responses are people writing in to say, I went through that too, and here's my story. It's a very private thing being put into a very public forum, and it creates all these little intimate connections, reader to writer, that I find sort of extraordinary.
I just wanted to add that, you know, this was really the piece of my work that I've gotten more response. I mean, as Dan said earlier, the emails just poured in with people, you know, telling me their stories. And, you know, so I am thrilled to be in here because it really is something that a lot of people connected with.
That's Brendan Halpin. He was a contributor to Modern Love, 50 True and Extraordinary Tales of Desire, Deceit, and Devotion. Before him, Daniel Jones, who edited the book and edits the Sunday New York Times column that the book came from. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.